Hello, welcome to the Cosmic Eye Show. I am your host, Jason Napolitano, and I have on the line my co-host, Mr. Chris Sheridan. How you doing?
Hey.
Did you like that? Back.
Yeah, that's need a little echo, a little reverb, and the thunderous applause.
From the thousands of
masses, from the throng.
The throng of ancient wisdom hungry listeners.
So get in there later, just fly that in.
Yeah, exactly. There it is. It's as if we're at a KISS concert in 1978. So there you go. All right. So it is Sunday. Thank you for joining us on the show. We appreciate you guys being here. This is our 101st episode. So our 100th episode was our last episode. If you didn't get a chance to hear it, that was the Emmett Fox Friday that we did. So for this 101st episode, we're doing a show we're calling Manly Hall 101. So what exactly does that mean, you ask? Well, Chris, why don't you tell them what that means?
Well, this is 2020, and Manly Hall started his professional career in 1919. So this is 101 years since he began his work. His career lasted 70 years, so it's really only been 30 years that we haven't had him, but still have his teachings. And it's 101 because we're going to kind of give a nice overview. We talk a lot over these last 100 previous episodes about Manly Hall, but this is, if you don't know who he is, or maybe you've heard of him, but don't know much about him, hopefully we can get a little bit of an overview. There's so much to talk about, so much to discuss about Mr. Hall and his works. But I think we can give a pretty good overview.
Absolutely. And of course, another sort of thing that's connected to this 101 idea is our very first episode that we did was on the secret teaching. So we set out, you know, this podcast with the intention of, you know, being pretty heavy on Manly Hall's work, and actually did probably 20 or 30 episodes were revolving around his work. So we're kind of getting back to that and just kind of making a nod and a gesture towards our appreciation for that fine philosopher and that wonderful gentleman. Reverend Stephen Heller likes to say, the Plato of Los Angeles. So,
well, that's a great way to describe him, and that's probably a good starting point, because he started in Los Angeles and lived in the Los Feliz area and died at age 89 in 1990. Very much Los Angeles was his whole, he toured, he went, you know, around the world to speak, but he's an LA philosopher, and that's part of the quirkiness and interesting. There's Hollywood stories involved with him. So yeah. It's a real thing.
Yeah. You know, and that was funny too, because, Dr. Heller was talking about that. And by the way, Dr. Heller is the bishop of the Gnostic Church, and he was one of the main speakers at the Philosophical Research Society, which is the group that Manly Hall founded, and that building is still on Los Feliz and Griffith Park in Los Angeles. And of course, as we've talked about a million times, both Chris and I work there, and that is in fact where we met. So we owe our friendship to the great Manly Hall as well. But he was talking about how Manly Hall used to talk about Los Angeles, and he would say, like, how lucky everybody who lived in Los Angeles was to be there, because it was this, he felt it was this great spiritual center that was going to really kind of change the world. And he was not wrong about that. If you look at some of the ideas and movements that have come out of Los Angeles over the last 100 years, I mean, it's remarkable. You know, the modern evangelical Christian movement comes out of Los Angeles. Self-realization fellowship with Yogananda comes out of Los Angeles. The PRS, obviously. Not to mention the countless, you know, media and art and you know, various cultural things that have come out of there. The 60s, of course, were born in San Francisco, but really grew up in Los Angeles, let's be honest, and then were exported to the rest of the world through Los Angeles, through the movies and music and art and so on, right? So a huge and important center. And it was
like, in the story, if you were to tell the story of Manly Hall, Los Angeles would have to be more than a backdrop. It may even be like one of the characters.
Like a character, indeed. And now he was not born there. Tell us a little bit about how he started out and how he got there and so on.
Well, he was born in Canada and raised with his maternal grandmother because his mom, well, moved out to California when he was a young boy. And that's how he wound up here as a teenager, connecting with her in Oceanside. We can get to that. But he started, when he came to America, I think as a 17-year-old, he went to New York. He worked at a magic shop, and one of his jobs was to take care of the animals, all the rabbits and the doves and the animals that the magicians would use in New York City. And he also worked on Wall Street and for a little while. And he saw the materialism, saw somebody jump out of a window. This would have been, you know, probably 10 years before the crash on Wall Street in 1929. But there were still problems then. Mm-hmm. Anyway, yeah. He came out here, went to Oceanside, where his mother was a healer. And that's where he learned publishing and it's the Rosicrucian Fellowship, very different than the AMORC Rosicrucians. And then he came to LA and started speaking at the place called the Church of the People, soon took it over, but started in 1919 and was full-time by 1920. And he spoke every week, maybe many times a week, until he died in 1990. Thousands of lectures, just thousands, an incredible body of work. It would take hours just to go through his bibliography and, you know, lecture series, just hugely prolific.
So it's interesting because you mentioned, and I know about this myself a little bit, is that from working on Wall Street, you know, I know, like you said, he saw someone jump out of a window and he saw the greed and the panic and so on, and he saw the materialism running wild. And again, that, you know, that's interesting because, you know, as we said, we're kind of paralleling the time that he started his career with, you know, with our time today. And, you know, you could argue that in some ways, you know, we're more materialistic than we were in 1919. And certainly there's more people in cities and more people living a sort of technologically oriented lifestyle and more people plugged into the matrix, as it were, than there were certainly in 1919, when people were, you know, they were starting to rush to the cities for work and so on. And there was a massive migration of people coming from rural areas to the cities for jobs and so on. But that transition hadn't taken place yet. And I think the bulk of the people in the United States in 1919, 1920, probably up to the early 30s, I would imagine, you know, lived a more rural lifestyle, meaning closer to the earth, meaning raising your own animals and farming, or at least living in a small town. And, you know, you're doing some sort of hands-on work as a smith or a mechanic or something that's ancillary to the farming communities and so on, right? So much closer to the earth, certainly, than we are today. But he even began to see that greed and that materialism starting to form and starting to shift the way that people were looking at life spiritually. And he was very fond of that saying. And it wasn't his saying. He got it from somewhere else, but I don't think he could ever put his finger on where he got it from. But it was an idea, because Dr. Heller was talking about this in one of his lectures. But he used to say spiritual materialism quite a bit. He would talk about how America was kind of in this, you know, caught in the grips of this spiritual materialism. And I think that's a really great way to put it. And in some ways, and I think you'd agree with me here, and I want you to share your thoughts on this. We're caught in almost a situation probably worse than the spiritual materialism he was dealing with, at least in the early days of his career, today. Would you agree with that?
Well, in a relative way, they're probably a lot closer. So a person of 1920, the changes and the rapid acceleration with technology, compared to where they were in the 1800s and everything, was probably just as shocking and like pulling a Band-Aid off. It was, you know, it was kind of painful to make these changes. So there's definitely a parallel. We're used to having more media and more technology, but we're also going through a similar thing. And I think that's why this, you know, 101 theme is really good, because well, look at 1920. It was right after World War I and all that suffering. That's in the, you know, materialism of destruction.
Sure.
And there was a big flu pandemic, 1918, 1919, 1920, women finally were granted the right to vote in this country, but that didn't just happen in 1920. So all through the time of his teens growing up, great social change, great technological advancements, radio and, cars and transcontinental railway, expanding. There was moving at a much faster pace, right? Cities, skyscrapers were starting. But there was also a hope that this, could have been a good time, that, if we did away with some of this materialism, we would have, a chance to build a greater society, that's better for everybody.
Yeah.
There's revolutions and, the communist revolution. So there's really a lot going on. There's a lot going on now that's very similar. But back to spiritual materialism, I think he was, it's like a snake oil salesman is to medicine. And he was probably just early in his career, in his 20s, he was probably just as much against that spiritual materialism as he was against actual materialism with goods and material items.
Yeah.
He thought that was a disservice. You're really sending people the wrong way if you're suggesting that wisdom and enlightenment can be bought for, a certain price and over a weekend, and I'm the person that can give it to you. There's no royal road. He knew it was a disciplined approach, and anybody who was selling a quick and easy way was not selling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. And I think particularly at that time, and today too, though, in our society, we're kind of addicted to these ideas of the three steps to this or the seven steps to that or the quick and easy way to get rich or the overnight way to, build a $1 million business online or whatever other nonsense that people are trying to sell you. And again, it's not that Manly Hall was against capitalism and he wasn't against, having a nice material existence and so on. What he was against was the idea of greed and devoting your entire life to earning money without any thought of a spiritual life and inner life and without any thought for any outer circumstances beyond, your own material happiness. I think that's what he was really, really concerned with. And he saw that's where, we were heading. And I think you could argue that today, we've come to this almost like apotheosis of that sort of thinking in a lot of ways. And now we're kind of turning back into, maybe an older way of looking at things, trying to get into a more natural way of looking at things and getting rid of a lot of the things that we thought were progress, to go back to more sort of basic ways of living and, organic farming and people crafting things and making things and appreciating handmade goods again and things like that. And so you see, that's the, I think the turn, the in an antiodromia, I guess you'd call it, right? An antiodromia, that's what it is. The turning in on itself or the turning to the opposite that Jung talked about, So, obviously anytime anything goes a certain distance, you're going to see it turn back on itself. So, I think what doesn't change and what we're going to talk about as we go along is this underpinning of the ancient wisdom, is this continual reliance on and this continual stream of this golden chain that goes back to prehistory, that's all of our heritage as human beings, that's the collected wisdom of, the ancestors from multiple cultures, but it has a universal thread and a universal theme that reaches back into the, dawn of time as far as we know. And then mythology tries to reach back even further past, history and so on to illuminate some of the things when, man was maybe in a different conscious state or, in a less evolved state and things like that, and trying to speculate, how we made some of our advances and things like that. And, the ancient wisdom tries to address some of that. But it's this perennial wisdom, this wisdom that is always relevant that we're talking about. And that's really what interested him and why we talk about him and why we believe his work is still so relevant is because it rests on the shoulders of these giants and these ancient sages, right?
Right. And that was really the centerpiece of his motivation, his mission, and his life's work, was to gather up from literally gathering up books and texts and documents from all over the world in huge, huge library that's, you know, mostly still intact, and making all that available using 20th century, you know, methods of printing and, like I said, radio, and he embraced every bit of tech that came along afterwards, that it was important and necessary, right, to revive and make available to everybody this ancient wisdom that has served civilization since, like you're saying, the dawn of time, probably before time, before they knew what time was. There was some keeper of the wisdom that made sure the tribe or the, you know, the cave dwellers, you know, kept them alive, mm-hmm. This existence. And the more we move away from that, the more trouble there is in the world, and more importantly, in the hearts of the human being. And to all the problems, you know, of today are the problems of every other day.
Yeah.
The ancient wisdom is just as modern as anything else because it's timeless and it transcends the flavor of the day or who's in power or which empire is running the world or this tech thing, or they still hold true, which is why they're true again now. So it could easily say we are in a similar situation in 2020 that perhaps the world was in 1920,
mm-hmm.
and having this long history of ancient wisdom, it's the heritage, it's yeah. the birthright of every living being, well, at least human being on the planet, you know, it's ours.
Yeah.
And yeah. it's useful, it's practical, it's relevant, it just has to be represented, you know, every so often in a new way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, change form, but the underlying story, the essence of this, the history, the wisdom of the ages, of the race, that is the human race, needs to live. It needs, the candle needs another light keeper mm-hmm. to keep the light burning and make yeah. it available through this darkness.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. By the way, I have to mention, it sounded like somebody started a dune buggy in the room that you're in. Was there a dune buggy in your room?
No, but there was a tuner car zipping through the driveway.
Okay. So,
kind of putt-putting, but yeah.
So a prop car from the Fast and the Furious was just...
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, gotcha. Ghost
of... what's his name?
I always love that. Like, I don't know if you watched Entourage, but Ari, the power agent, when he got kicked out of his agency that he helped to build, he's like, I came to work in $100,000 Mercedes Benz, and I'm going home in a prop car from the Fast and the Furious, because he had his assistant drive him home in his car, and he was driving one of those little tuner cars. I love that line. I can't forget that one. So, has nothing to do with the ancient wisdom, but a little levity always is good. All right, so the point to all this, and I like what you're saying, and that's it's fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about some of these ideas, because we do often talk about the ancient wisdom and don't necessarily talk about the specifics of some of it. And I think, you know, obviously when you speak of the ancient wisdom, it has many varieties and many, you know, thousands of different teachings and teachers and so on, and it spans time, you know, and it includes Egyptian wisdom, Sumerian wisdom, Babylonian wisdom, you know, up through the Greeks, through the Romans, through the, you know, the Renaissance into, you know, the Neoplatonists, and then, you know, the new Hermetic schools that arose. And, you know, you could go on and on and on and chart its trajectory of course, the Gnostics and the modern Gnostic movements and, you know, up to this day where we would call, you know, some of these teachings now, they use the term maybe New Age or consciousness studies or something like this, or comparative religious studies, something like that, whatever it is. But the point is that these his teachings do share some things in common. You know, we're not going to be able to go over every single thing, obviously, but, you know, one of the biggest things that, you know, the mystery schools and the teachers of ancient wisdom and, you know, the true schools of occult and esoteric philosophy, one of the things that happened was there was always a sort of a graded path. So basically, in the ancient wisdom, there was a three-level sort of process that one went through. So it started out where you were like a neophyte or a student, and that was sort of your testing period. That was your sort of a probationer, let's call it. And you moved into that level that might be known as a disciple or something like that. And then, you know, at that level, you're sort of proving yourself even more, but you're sort of starting to gain some of the esoteric wisdom and moving to some of the higher level things. And then, of course, the adept was the third level, and that was sort of conferred on a spiritual level, in essence. That was an esoteric sort of an initiation that occurred, and that usually had some mental powers that went along with it, some clairvoyance or some other sort of, you know, extrasensory sort of powers and stuff that it conveyed, or, you know, special levels of healing or wisdom or so on. And, you know, very few people would make it to the adept level. Most people ended up as, you know, as a disciple or something like that. But that's a very practical way of looking at it. Of course, you know, most of the modern mystery schools are built on that, the three-level, you know, system. Of course, Freemasonry and, you know, some of the Rosicrucian orders and different orders and so on. Magical orders have that three level or seven level or 10 level thing, but there's usually a three level portion of it in some part of the work. And I think that, you know, that is one of these things where there's so much wisdom just in that structuring right off the bat that I would say before we even discuss like what, you know, what are some of the things they were actually teaching. But the fact that, you know, you've got to go through a sort of level, you know, certain levels to receive higher levels of teaching implies that a student doesn't just jump online and confer himself a degree or, you know, look up something on Google and suddenly understand some esoteric wisdom. It actually requires a practice. You know, it would require a period of silence or a period of concentration or, you know, basic duties that needed to be fulfilled or basic teachings that needed to be memorized or trials that one had to go through on some level or another. It's a sort of a proving ground. And I think one of the challenges today with spiritual material is that so much of it is just out there in the open that people read something and then they suddenly exclaim that they're woke or they're awake or they're a master or they're an adept or they're this or that. And you haven't done any of the preliminary work to sort of get to the point where you even understand what that means. Do you know what I mean? And I think there's something very practical in kind of going slowly through this work and having to kind of prove yourself worthy of that knowledge that makes you strong. It makes you have perseverance, focused mind. It gives you more desire to find out what is at those next levels and so on that you can't get just by Googling something. Just, do you know what I mean?
Well, I do. And then that's the real, we're in the information age at this point, the digital information age. And it is very, very easy to get any bit of knowledge, information that has been written down or there's a picture of it or a recording. There are great archival websites. As a matter of fact, the thousands of books that Manly Hall collected over his life, he went around the world and found rare books that were very, very expensive, even in the 20s and 30s to work on his collection. Now, some of those books, thanks to him for many of them, have been scanned and they're free and available. You can just click and you're there. He's making hundreds and thousands of dollars, you know. So it's very easy to get that factual information, but there's a real mistake when you confuse information with wisdom. You know, this ancient knowledge is more than just what's written on the paper. As a matter of fact, that's just the first step. Or it's one half, but it's probably the small half. The rest is putting it into use and unfolding that in you. That's just a guideline, the lessons that to actually have that knowledge turn into any kind of wisdom really powerful, you know, mental energy to where you can make your life in this world much better and much easier. You have to put it to work. Just like a diet or, you know, an exercise program or learning an instrument, it's something that has to be done. And that's when you can hear the music.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good point. It's like, you know, gathering wisdom and, you know, working through this material and, you know, working on your inner life and your spiritual development and your conscious transformation within, unconscious transformation within, and so on. It is a lot like learning a craft or learning to play music or something like that, in that, you know, you get some information and then you've got to continually practice that. Like in the case of a musician, you're going to play your scales, you know, obviously you learn your notes and you're going to learn how to read music, and then you're going to practice and you're going to learn chords if you're playing guitar, and, you know, all these different things. These are the sort of craft elements of it. And then as time goes on, you know, you move up to the higher levels, you learn more complicated songs, you might learn how to solo, and that's going to be something that's more interiorly motivated and creative. You know, of course, we all, and this is the same thing with, this is an analogy between, you know, music and esoteric wisdom, is like, you know, we all want to jump up and do a, you know, a solo like Eddie Van Halen or something, like when we first pick up the guitar, but we don't want to do the, you know, the 15 or 20 years of work that it took to get there, right? And so, you know, it's like anything else. And that's the thing with one of the dangers of this spiritual materialism that he talks about, is that people jump right into really advanced techniques that they probably, you know, have no business getting into, or they want to mess around with, you know, mediums, and they want to, you know, channel this entity, or they want to do, you know, really heavy duty past life work, or they want to just, you know, take some DMT and see the spirit world. And, you know, not to knock any of those things by any means, those are all valid approaches to spiritual expansion. But most people, I think, don't want to do some of the preliminary work that's necessary to kind of ready yourself for some of this higher work, because it's challenging. And it's tedious, and it's not very glamorous. And it's things like, well, learning to control your temper and rooting out your, you know, your prejudices and unclear thinking, you know, learning how to think more logically and clearly without so much emotion behind things in certain situations, or, you know, not letting your buttons get pushed in this or that situation. You know, things that sound kind of mundane, it's like, well, no, that's not esoteric. Well, it is, though. Because the thing is if it's like saying, and this is how, what people don't realize about this work, it would be like you wanting to be the CEO of a corporation, but you're not willing to learn any of the things you need to know. You don't want to know anything about accounting or leadership or, you know, or the structure of the organization, or, you know, law, or any of these things that you need to know as a leader of a major corporation, for example. And you want to just jump right in and do that work because you feel like you could. You know what I'm saying? And the esoteric work is no different. You've got to do the same preparation that you would for any sort of job or any sort of difficult thing that you want to do. And it means learning basic things about philosophy and, you know, working on your memory, understanding the symbolism, reading mythology, understanding religion. And, you know, I mean, we could go on and on and on. Obviously, you know, we will as time goes on, because, you know, one of the things both you and I want to do, and we're going to be offering this, you know, in the near future, is teach people how to approach this material in a methodical way, because it's not something that you really know how to do just because you look things up on the internet, right? It has a practical way of doing things, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And one of the terms Manly Hall used was ensoul, E-N-S-O-U-L. sort of like when you embody something, you know, you're the spitting image of that, or you're the embodiment of health or vitality. That to the body is what knowledge is to the soul. It has to be ensouled. You're bringing it in, just like you would bring food into your digestive system and your taste buds. You are bringing these words and great lessons and the collected history of wisdom into your, not just your body, but your soul. And that requires a lot of inner work. And that is honesty with yourself, the ability to look at yourself and change some things about yourself, being responsible for the things that you've done in the past, and being, you know, an honest person that is internally honest. You're honest with yourself.
Yeah.
About who you are. And that's where that's probably the hardest part about the whole thing, is because there is no out there wisdom and I'm a wizard and I'm going to manifest this, only to the degree that you have yourself in order.
Yep.
Is your magic or your mind science. There's a recent one in the last 10 years called The Secret that, you know, hugely popular. Made it sound really easy. Well, just change your mind and you change your world. Just think of something and it'll show up in your driveway. And, you know, there's some truth to that, or actually that is true, but that's not the full picture. And I think that would almost fall into the same category of this spiritual materialism that Hall was talking about 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. And again, I think you're right about that. It's like it may or may not work depending on the capacity of your mind and how you've trained yourself, or how, you know, what your faith is like, or, you know, how focused your mind is, and so on. And what your beliefs are, your belief structure, what you believe is possible for yourself and so on. Those can all be factors in that sort of, you know, new thought, secret-y kind of thinking. And, you know, of course, new thought goes much deeper than all of that, but that's the sort of pop thing, is this law of attraction idea, where really, you know, basically people are just kind of turning the universe into a wishing machine. Like, whatever I can come up with that's good for me and think about it and imagine it, then that's what's going to pop into my life. And you know what? We talk about that stuff a lot. We talk about that on the Emmett Fox Show, and we talk about the possibility of having that stuff happen. And it is possible. And you can make those things happen. What philosophy does, though, and this is why you want to train yourself, is philosophy and the ancient wisdom give you first the clarity to see the things that you should be working towards, constructive things, and not just egotistical desires or things that are going to harm other people or things that are completely, you know, beyond your ability to control them or work them well. You know, it's like the Sorcerer's Apprentice. If, you know, we talked about this earlier before the show, but I don't know, it just popped into my head, is that little segment of Fantasia, where it's Fantasia, right?
Right.
Yeah. And so Mickey's in there and the wizard's away and Mickey's an apprentice and he gets a hold of the book and he starts making all this stuff happen that he can't control. The place starts flooding, brooms are running around. It's, you know, things are going crazy. And, you know, that is one of the things that, you know, this sort of preliminary work prevents. You may be able to, you know, create all kinds of things with your mind and with your magical work and with your ritual and so on. But the question is, should you be doing those things, and are they the best thing for you and the people around you, and is your magic and your mental work going to cause more harm and good than good? And, you know, and those are the kinds of things that the ancient wisdom would have had you address, you know, prior to using those things. And that's why, you know, a lot of people want to throw these ideas out like, well, it's just simplistic, you know, it's like, I don't need to learn how to control myself, and I don't need to learn how to be a good person. I don't need to learn how to give charity and do good works and things like that, because that's, you know, I want a new Ferrari. And so I'm going to manifest that with my mind. It's like, well, okay. I mean, you can try to do that. And you may even get that Ferrari with your mind, but it may or may not be the best thing for you. It may, you know, you might end up getting an accident that it puts you, you know, put you out of commission. You might end up getting an accident that kills you, cuts your life short, because you weren't supposed to have that thing yet. You know, that's where the, you know, he talks about the spiritual materialism. It's like, it's not that the material stuff is bad. And it's not that your desires are bad. It's that you need to learn how to temper your mind and work on yourself so that you're manifesting things through your work and through your mind and through your ritual that are good for you, the people around you, and the rest of the world. And that's what it means to be a true philosopher, you know, in line with the ancient wisdom, right?
Well, that's one of the things also that the ancient wisdom provides is a framework for what it is, and more importantly, why it is that you want something. Well, say you want a Ferrari. Well, that's fine. If you want to drive a fast car and you like the way they look and you can afford it, you know, that's great. But that's not always why somebody gets a sports car. Yep. It's so we can show up your neighbor, or then maybe you'll get attention from other people. Maybe you'll get a date. Maybe you'll feel powerful now, or maybe you'll shove it in their face because now I got mine. Those are very different reasons to want to conjure up a Ferrari. Okay, if you want attention, if you want respect, if you want those kinds of things, and Ferrari's not necessarily going to give that to you. It might give you some version of that. Mm-hmm. The ancient wisdom is a process that allows you to go deeper into that. Okay, I really want attention. Well, why do I want attention? Well, I feel like I'm not being heard or respected. What can I do that's respectful? What respectful thing I can do for my community that will give me respect? A lot more than a Ferrari would, if that's the only reason why you want it. So the ancient wisdom and philosophy is, you know, ethics is a huge, huge part of philosophy.
Yep.
And, you know, why would you want to do something? But it also helps you see through things and get to what's underneath it and what you really want. Yes, mind science and ancient wisdom can help you get what you want, but it also helps you determine and develop these values in yourself.
Exactly. Well, because you can use those same tools to develop spiritual wisdom, to develop, you know, fortitude and perseverance so that you can work through the challenges in your life, to develop a clarity of vision for your life and so on. And I think that's the preliminary work that these, you know, the student and disciple level sort of trainings give you. And the thing is, people want to jump up to that adept level and just kind of, you know, start waving the magic wand and, you know, making things happen. And you're right, it's like you need to kind of examine, and they, you know, most good magical systems even today, amongst the, you know, the newer traditions that came out of Freemasonry and so on, and I've talked about them several times, like the OTO, the OTA, the Golden Dawn, and the different, you know, versions of Thelema and Crowley's work, and a lot of the, you know, the modern magic that comes out of England and then moves to the US, it does have this idea built into it. And a lot of people, again, in those systems don't listen to it as well, but it has the idea that, you know, before you go trying to do any of this magical astral work and, you know, trying to work with these different spiritual entities or trying to evoke this or that, you know, magical spirit through this or that procedure, learning all these complicated sigils and rituals and so on, and Hebrew and Latin, you know, terminologies and Kabbalistic worlds, and, you know, it's extremely complicated. They, you know, they tell you, look, get your own house in order. Go, a lot of them say, go get some therapy and, you know, deal with some of the issues in your own life and make sure this isn't some sort of power play or some sort of, you know, complex trying to play itself out. Make sure you're doing this work that is supposed to be called theurgy. Basically, it's a sort of, you know, a sort of godly kind of a mystical tradition. It's not, you know, supposed to be used in, you know, in negative ways. You know, make sure your own house is in order though before you do these really complicated, abstract, sort of powerful, you know, psycho-spiritual and magical techniques. You know, and that's where it's like we want to just skip right ahead. And, you know, and I understand it. I get it. I empathize with that. I mean, it's like the fun stuff is, you know, the high level stuff. You want to go right to the PhD. No one wants to do the 101 class or the, you know, the basic classes, right? You want to go right into the cool stuff. But, you know, there's a reason though why people get discouraged and they move from spiritual movement to spiritual movement, from guru to teacher to this to that, and never making any progress, because oftentimes we are not willing to do the challenging basic work that needs to be done to make that progress. You know what I mean? And that includes things like learning how to memorize things, doing work that helps your memory be stronger, working on visualizing, and then of course working on your own sort of day-to-day life. Like, how am I living as a person? You know, am I making an adequate living in my job? And how's, you know, am I treating people well in my day-to-day life? How are my relationships? What's my family life like? You know, we want to escape off into the idea of this magical world and stuff, and that can be really compelling. But the real progress is made when you're able to, you know, work on that kind of mundane stuff and really get a handle on that, and then move into this more esoteric and occult work with all those basics handled. Then it's as if you've spent all that time like tuning up your car and like building this, speaking of tuner cars, you know, building this super powerful engine that finally you're ready to fire up, and you have the skills to drive this thing, and you've learned how to see super clearly, and you've got your competitive edge and your logic and clarity. So, I mean, you're really firing on all cylinders, as they say, once you've done this basic work, right? You haven't jumped in ahead of yourself.
Right. And if you do, you're just going to bring who and what you are to that. If you have a stressed, you know, mental attitude, if your affairs are chaotic and out of order, and then you get in a race car, or if you develop a spiritual practice, those things will creep in with it too. So it's really in your best interest, but it's, you have to, and like alchemy, one of the first operations is calcionado, and that's a burning, which is just like a, you know, an ash ritual to purify, or sometimes when people meditate or do a shaman journey, they'll surround themselves in a protective orb of white light or a golden ball or something. Is really start at home. Start with yourself, and because that's what you're going to bring out into the world. And yeah, your magic, your art, whatever it is, this won't be, it'll reflect, you know. Well,
and that calcinado that you're talking about is a burning off of that dross. It's a burning off and purifying of all those negative emotions and, you know, and sort of like misunderstandings, and a really sort of a burning away of some of the lower stuff, you know, so that you can move forward and sort of up this scale of, you know, this alchemical process, right? But it starts in
perfect though, you know. Thing is, steps, and you are consciously making those choices, and the action to purify your heart, your mind, your thoughts, your emotions, to where they're kinder, they're more easygoing, they're more connected with nature and more in harmony with the world. That's really half the work. I mean, that's mostly what it is. It's the alchemist. Yes, they spend time in their lab, but you're really spending that time on yourself. You know, the great mythic journey, you know, we didn't even get into mythology. That's another great, you know, hugely, you know, broad part of the ancient wisdom is a myth or an allegory or a spiritual wisdom tale to give us some information on how we need to go about living our lives or what we might expect at certain turning points. And it's a step-by-step process, but the first one, initiation, you have to be thrown into this new world. And, you know, by the end, you're a changed person. You are transformed. But when, early on, you know, it's even in the movies, you're like a fish out of water. You're taken out from your home world, your comfort zone, and now you have this challenge, this call to adventure.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to really have to become somebody else and be willing to lose, you know, your, you know, deeply held beliefs on your identity, or your grudges that you're gripping, or things like that. You have to have a willingness to Because you really, that's really the goal, is to change yourself.
That's a great point. And, you know, kind of to bring us full circle again, Bennett, back to Manly Hall. I mean, most of his lectures and most of his work, especially towards the, you know, the second half of his life and stuff, as he became more mature and stuff, was very practical. You know, he got back, you know, to the basics and really would talk about people's behavior and ethics and philosophy. And, you know, he'd talk about what was happening in the day and, you know, the current time and so on. But always with an eye towards, or, you know, and always with an eye informed by this ancient wisdom and by these esoteric traditions, you know, so that he never got away from that base. But, you know, a lot of the more magical work and occult work that he did was earlier when he was a younger man. And, you know, certainly that's, you know, some of the favorite stuff of most people, myself included. But really, you know, it was the foundation that he kind of built all this on. And I think as he became older, he began to stress, you know, some of the more practical and ethical stuff, because I think he saw some of those problems. And he does talk about that oftentimes, of how, you know, people get caught up in these different spiritual fads or, you know, occult practices that they're not ready for, and they haven't built that foundation yet. And I think that's one of the things that he stressed a lot in certainly in his lectures. And certainly in, you know, a lot of what's in the pamphlets and so on, right? And all that. But to kind of get back to his work, you know, the first show that we did, we talked a lot about the secret teachings. And the secret teachings, by the way, if you do not have it, is a must-own book. And get, you know, really any edition that you can. I mean, there's obviously more beautiful ones that you want to own if you're collecting them, but, you know, there's reader's editions and so on that you can get. The Tartar Penguin one is a you know, a cheaper version that you can get if you just want to study that. But it's you know, it's an encyclopedia of this knowledge, and it really is, as Dr. Heller talked about, Manly Hall talked about it with him, he would say, you know, all of his work as he went on in his life was just really taking, he said, after he did that, the secret teachings, it was really just about building on that foundation. And he would just take a paragraph or a page or something, and he would write a whole pamphlet or another book on something that he pulled out of the secret teachings. And he actually had told Dr. Heller that. He said, you know, that was the most important piece of work that I ever did in my life, and everything else is built around that book. So, you know, that's an interesting thing. So highly recommend, if you do not own that book, to get a copy and begin wherever you want in it. And that's the beautiful thing about that book. You can start at the beginning and read it through like a book, or you can just grab some little section of it and pick a picture that you like or a symbol that you like and read into that, you know, because we talked about this, I think, in that secret teaching. I'm pretty sure we talked about how he had mentioned, it's in the foreword or something, where he talks about how every chapter, it was in some supplemental material, wasn't it? Where he talks about how every chapter is basically the same story, just in a different symbolic form, right?
Right, and that's comparative mythology, comparative religion, yeah. Writ large. So yes, if it's an Egyptian thing, if it's Masonic, if it's Rosicrucian, if it's alchemy, anything else, you know, each chapter is really different, a different culture, Greek oracles, all different kinds of symbolism, Native American symbolism, a whole chapter dedicated to that. It's the story of us, the single story that is told so many times in so many traditions across all cultures and throughout all time, is the story of us. The hero's journey is the story of our lives. You know, it's this transformation, this alchemical transformation is us becoming a more mature being. It's the path of humanity. And each time we have to, you know, learn this, teach it, apply it, and grow just a little bit more as the collective grows and moves and progresses.
Exactly.
It's maturing. It's a transformation. And it pulls us out of this lie, what the Hindus called it, Maya, right? This world of illusions that we live in. Most everything we see, you know, the world is or like the Matrix, you know, it's all a schematic or something, that that there's a real truth, the reality behind all these kind of facts and all these illusions, these projections on the cave wall, to borrow from Plato. But that's what all these stories are. That's what all these myths and religious is, to transcend that.
Yep.
Be in the world, but not of it. There is a truth behind all the facts around us. There's a deeper truth about us, about who we are.
There's that one of the things that, you know, gets, that's a universal sort of in all this ancient wisdom, is the idea of the absolute, the idea of this, you know, transcendent realm, this spiritual being, this universal power behind all of this, that we're really just having this experience of reflected consciousness, of that, you know, that super consciousness, that that absolute behind all of this, that we're, you know, and that's where, you know, Maya kind of comes into play. It's this sort of veil that allows us, it's sort of the screen really that the movie is projected onto. But this thing that, you know, that the ancient wisdom constantly would get back to, is that there is meaning to it. And that's kind of one of the ideas and why this is, this information is so important now, and why it was so important in the early 1900s when Manly Hall was talking about this, and even later into his career, is that over time, modern society, postmodern society, as we call it today, the industrial age, the media age, the information age, all these places that we've gotten to and moved through, you know, has sort of lost its bearings, lost its connection to the absolute, to the spiritual truth behind it, behind everything. And even to this point now, we will say, well, that's just a subjective idea in one person's mind. And, you know, this is the way that they conceive of the universe, and there's no, you know, there's no real objective truth and all this, and some of these postmodern arguments. And fair enough, you know, a certain amount of it is a subjective experience, and you can make that argument and be okay with that. But just because people are having subjective experiences does not negate the fact that there's something behind that, and that there is, that there isn't an objective truth behind all of our experience, and that there isn't this unity behind all of it. And that's what the ancient wisdom would assert. It's that there is purpose, there's movement, there's an evolutionary progression, that, you know, people are on a sort of trajectory of learning, and, you know, it's by no means a straight line. Sometimes it goes down, sometimes it goes up, sometimes the universe is coming, you know, the universe comes into existence, the universe goes out of existence, you know, it's very cyclical. But there is a sort of spiraling towards more consciousness and better consciousness and higher consciousness. And we're on a trajectory of growth and learning, you know, and that is something that, you know, we're all struggling to achieve. And, you know, the ancient wisdom would say, well, look, you know, it's not a progressive ideal utopian social experiment out there that we really need. It's a transcendent spiritual foundational experience that we need within, that, you know, we build from, we build society around that. You know what I mean? It's from the inside out, in essence, and it comes from, but it does come from a source that is in and through everything material. And that's the tough thing. It's sort of a dichotomy or a paradox. It's like, well, yes, there's this material world, and then yes, there's also the spiritual world, and they're completely intertwined. And they're, you know, they're existing in and of each other. You know, and the ancient wisdom would show this sort of chain of hierarchies and so on that exist in the invisible world. And again, you know, scientifically or objectively, we may or may not ever be able to observe those worlds or observe the sort of structure of the universe. But, you know, seers and sages and clairvoyants and wise men and women have seen the structure in visions, in dreams, in artwork, in you know, during prayer, ecstatic dance, and so on. And they've come, you know, through the use of psychedelics and different types of substances, whatever. And they, you know, they've shown kind of a map of meaning. And, you know, it's the same sort of thing that exists within ourselves. And, you know, there's a structure and a meaning to it, I guess, is my point. It's a long-winded way of saying there is meaning, there is purpose to life, and there is something greater than us that is at work. You know, there is transpersonal power that exists within us and without. And, you know, we have to rely on that and realize it and help form a conception of it before we can ever, you know, find any kind of meaning in our lives. You know, even if you describe that as love or as wisdom or as understanding or as caring or compassion, and you're shooting towards that ideal, an ideal is still a transcendent value, isn't it?
Well, it is. And it's these ideals are for the building blocks, you know, the first principles from which all things come. And if you have a strong foundation in these, you know, archetypal universals, then everything that comes after that will likely be successful and also in harmony. And Mr. Hall talked about, even wrote about it in Lectures on Ancient Philosophy in 1929, but it was the Platonic notion of the one, the beautiful, and the good. This, again, we'll go back to a three-part process or a three-way looking at something, and that the universe, we all are one. It is a singularity. It's not all these planets and they're all in there, but it's all part of a one system, and that is wholeness, that's healing, that's the human race. It's all the planets, all the galaxies, and stuff we don't even know about is still one. There's a oneness, a unity. The illusion is that there's all this separateness and conflict and division and diversion, but in essence, there is a oneness to the universe. And the beautiful, that in this ugliness that we see in people in the world and all around us and destructive powers of the universe, there is a beauty that underneath it all, it is a very beautiful expression of life. And the good, that we are going somewhere, that we are on, there is order in the chaos. It looks like chaos, it feels like chaos, but underneath it all, there is a very ordered universe that we can rely on when all the stuff on the surface is so unreliable. And so just even something simple like that, the one, the beautiful, and the good. Philosophy, ancient wisdom teaches us to look at things that way. And it's with that viewpoint that you can get beyond and see through some of the difficult parts of life that we're presented with. And that's the goal, and that's the process that we're touching on about ancient wisdom.
That's it. No, that's a good point. And, you know, we started out the show and we were going to talk quite a bit about Manly Hall, and I think we did. But, you know, then we kind of spoke about some of these ideas about the ancient wisdom, some things that are going on today, some different ideas and so forth. But I would say that Manly Hall's ideas were guiding all of the information that we talked about today, you know, not to speak for Mr. Hall, but I do think, you know, both of us are informed by his work. And so, and he kind of imbued with the essence of what he was trying to teach. So, you know, really, even if we didn't necessarily speak about Manly Hall the entire time specifically, he was between the lines of everything we were speaking about today. And we owe much to his work and to our, you know, our meeting there at the PRS. And so we're, you know, I'm greatly thankful for having been introduced to his work and having much of his work in my own library. And I continually reference it, as do you, and we do on the show as well. And so one of the big things we want to encourage you guys to do out there is to buy his books, to listen to his lectures, check out Manly Hall Society and listen to some of the great lectures that Chris has been putting up on there. He's done beautiful work on that audio, and you know, follow that and check that out. Lectures on Ancient Philosophy, which you just mentioned, is a fantastic book. It's heavy, it's dense, and it's packed with so much information. And it's, you know, it's a compendium that is a companion work to the secret teachings. It's kind of you know, it's kind of like the more ethical and philosophical side of it. So with the secret teachings, you got all the symbolic and the mythological and the, you know, sort of magical and occult symbolism and so on. And then in lectures on ancient philosophy, you know, you've got the ethical and philosophical side of things that, you know, the sort of Greek philosophy, the Neoplatonist view and so on. And so if you've got, honestly, if you've got those two books, you've pretty much got everything that he wrote about. Would you agree? I mean, the bulk of his messages are contained in those two works, wouldn't you say?
I think, well, at least the source material, and you're right, it is an encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. In, you know, later in life, well, not later, like from maybe the last 30 or 40 years of his 70-year career, really were spent putting things in everyday 20th century Los Angeles, America, language, yeah, and topics. Went through the Depression, you know, World War II and that destruction, the Cold War and the threat of nuclear annihilation, you know, the beatniks and the hippies all through the 60s and the pill and all these social and technological and world political events throughout his career. He always kept consistent with taking a view through this ancient wisdom lens. So if it worked throughout the entire 20th century, it'll work throughout this century and centuries to come. But the real important thing now is that, as he did, Mr. Hall, in the 20s, the 1920s, gathering up, devouring, digesting all this material and then representing it out to the public for a modern ear and a modern mind to be able to not only approach but understand and, more importantly, apply to your everyday life. That work still needs to be done. It needs to be done all the time in every age, every generation, or at least every 100 years. And I think we're on that phase again, that these ancient wisdom again, maybe taking where Manly Hall left off, or in a way doing some of the same thing, to get these ideas and ideals and really develop that sense of seeing and knowing and perception that goes way beyond academics and the material knowledge-based, mm-hmm, information age that we're in. That work still needs to be done. I think that's part of the work that we're doing.
Yeah.
Bringing these things back and talking about current events or always events that can be helped, that we can be helped by applying these ancient and venerated techniques.
Absolutely. Well put. I think that's going to wrap us up. So as you said, it is, you know, we're in this 100 years kind of period after, and, you know, he began his work. We find ourselves in a lot of the similar conditions, and we want to encourage you to go back to this ancient wisdom and study it and apply it and work on it, put it to work in your life. It's more important than ever. I think we're finding ourselves in a time of conscious transformation and, you know, a sort of an esoteric revival. I mean, you can see the interest in this material. You can see the excitement that people have rediscovering a lot of these magical and mystical traditions and all the ritual and so on. I see a lot of younger people doing cacao rituals and, you know, shaman stuff and, you know, really interested in Mr. Hall's work. And a lot of these older magical traditions are being raised up again, and, you know, the neo-pagan traditions and mystical Christianity and Gnosticism. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of information and excitement around that information on YouTube and on social media and so on. You see people, you know, wearing t-shirts with ancient symbols that they have no idea what they mean, but they're wearing them. So you can see that there's just a sea change of stuff going on here. And it is, I think, we're right in the middle of a revival of a new generation of this material, you know, finding new outlets and all that. But what it all shares in common is it it has this golden chain, this golden thread that goes back, you know, like we talked about, to the dawn of, you know, recorded history and even into prehistory and so on. And there is this tradition of wisdom. And the more, you know, really, it's hard to cover it in an hour. It's hard to cover it in 18 hours or 100 hours. But, you know, go to Mr. Hall's work and, you know, specifically the secret teachings of all ages, and get an overview, a really beautiful and detailed overview of this tradition, and begin to dive in. You know, and we'll talk more about the details of different traditions and so on as we've been doing. We're going to continue that work, and you know, we're motivated to really try to help create this real new age of change, and we hope that you guys are on board with us with that. So please continue to support us. We do appreciate you guys being here each week. Thank you, Chris. Great insights into Mr. Hall's work and other areas that we talked about today. I appreciate it.
All right, well, thank you, and this is a never-ending story.
So the never-ending story of ancient philosophy is what we're talking about each week. So thank you for joining us. We appreciate you guys here. You know, check us out at cosmiceye.org, or check Chris's book out. It is The Spirit in the Sky, and you can get that on Amazon, or you can see more about Chris at chrissheridan.com. Check us out at cosmiceye.org. And you can get in touch with us at info@cosmiceye.org if you wish. And again, if you're, you know, if you do start looking into Manly Hall's work and there's some area that you'd really like us to talk about, please hit us up. You can do that through the Anchor app as well at anchor.fm/cosmiceye. So those are the places where we are. And you can follow us on Instagram. Chris is at ChrisSheridan333. 333 or 33?
333.
333. And I am at Jason Napolitano. That's a long one. So just go to cosmiceye.org and you can find that information. So thank you again for joining us. We're praying for everybody. Have a great week. Stay safe out there. It's getting dangerous again. You know, I'm telling you, we're praying and we're meditating, and we're sending out positive energy to keep everybody healthy during all this crazy stuff, this virus and whatnot. So stay safe. Have a great week. Goodbye, and God bless.